Edutainment Learning is powered by Academica Virtual Education and Collegia TV. For more information, visit www.edutainmentlearning.com.
Well, my name is Vernon Noren Schmidt. The Noren was my mother's maiden name. And as you mentioned, I was born in January the 21st, 1926, in Reedley, California, where I did my education through high school. By that time, instead of entering into college, World War II was blooming and my brother had already gone in. So I felt it's my time to go in. And that's kind of how it started. That was in I graduated from Reedley High School in 1943, 17 years old, and came up here to the Fresno Airport. Today it was then Hammer Field. It was a recruiting airbase for B-25 and B-24 bombers. So that's, I got very excited about joining the Air Force. My brother was already in there and I could see it. It was a great opportunity. So that's kind of how I got started. However, when I went all through this process to join up, I was now 17 and I figured I could join up at that time. And lo and behold, if I didn't turn 18, and I got a great big brown envelope from President Roosevelt, and he stated very plainly in there, "You have been selected." And what did they need then? They needed troops. They needed people to carry a rifle. They needed people to, they needed infantrymen. And that's where I wound up.
Now, first of all, thank you to Tony Fusco, who had provided the screenshots for this PowerPoint with a lot of Vernon's background, but Tony is with the Arizona Jewish Historical Society. So Vern, can you take us through these pictures of what life was like when you decided to leave Reedley and join the military?
Well, of course, this was right climaxing the Great Depression that the whole world had been involved in, as well as America. Things were still pretty tight and tough. Jobs were scarce, but I would say that the military pretty well became a source of bodies joining and became, I guess you'd say, we became gainfully employed by the United States Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force. So many of us that became our job for several years. Mine was a total of 3 years in the service totally, because I did a stint in during the Korean War as well. I was called back into the service then, not willingly, but I was called back and served there also in stateside. So that's kind of how it was. People were beginning to realize that we were facing, you know, a worldwide conflict. And I would say the United States has always been ready to go and ready to do service and become a part to recognize how we can make freedom come as quickly as possible. And I believe we did it in World War II.
That is wonderful. And thank you for your service, not only in World War II, but also in the Korean War. So we'll go right through. So you were at Camp Roberts, correct?
Yes. In fact, I'm there right now at Camp Roberts.
Can you talk to the kids a little bit about what that was like as a 19-year-old going into a military camp, you know, right at the beginning of World War II?
Well, fortunate for me, I had done military exercise, or I should say learning how to march, how to handle various things that were going to be thrown at us. So when I was at Camp Roberts, in fact, I was at Camp Roberts, there was over 70,000 guys there doing various, and we were there supposedly for a 12-week course. Actually, I should say an 18-week course, but we were cut short because of the landings at Normandy, and then as they advanced, casualties became a reality. So we moved quickly through there. But Camp Roberts is probably known as the largest infantry replacement training center during World War II. It is still active today in a source, but in a much smaller. It's a service organization now, but it was a huge place. We had lots of territory. We're on the Coast Range Mountains, so we were not limited to any space. We could go anywhere, 50 miles either way, and have exercises. So it was a busy place, but I believe we learned, and they taught us how to. How to be a fighter, because infantry is for one purpose. You carry a rifle and you move and push the enemy or take care of the enemy a day at a time, a block at a time, a mile at a time, whatever you face. So, but I'm grateful because I feel I had good leadership taking us to learning how to fire an M1 rifle learning how to even exercise with a bayonet, which fortunately I never had to use in combat other than to cut open a can or something to eat out of them. But anyway, I feel that the training we received was very well received, and I learned a lot, and I'm grateful today because I believe there was practicality taught in there. You survive if you learn how to take care of yourself.
I bet. And I bet there was a bit of a culture shock because back then people didn't travel as much. And so I read some where that they were the men at that time, it was a complete culture shock because they didn't travel too far from their hometowns. And then all of a sudden they're so far from home.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I was Camp Roberts was about a little over 100 and some miles from my hometown, and I would hitchhike, get out on the highway there, right by one main highway right through California, get out there, and just with your uniform, didn't even need to put up your thumb, one or two cars would stop and say, where are you going? And I had to make sometimes three or four changes before I got home, but I never had a problem hitchhiking. The uniform spoke. I'm sorry that it doesn't seem like it exists in that way, fashion today, but people would slam on their brakes and say, where are you going, soldier? Tell them, get in. I'll take you as far as I'm going. So, yeah, it was. The population wasn't like it is today. My little hometown, when I left for the service, was 3,000, and we knew almost everybody. Today, there's over 30,000 people there in just a little farming town. But, we got people all over now. So anyway, but
it was truly a different time, what you're describing. But well, so after you leave Camp Roberts, can you kind of tell us of the journey from, okay, you get from America to Europe and you're getting ready to go to war? What was that like in those boxcars, if you could kind of describe it for the kids?
Well, I don't want to say there was secrecy, but we were told nothing. We were said, here's a pass. You have 7 days at home, and then you report to Fort Meade, Maryland. I mean, that's clear on the other side of the United States. So they gave you a ticket that would work with a Greyhound bus or work with a train. So I used both. When I got to Fort Meade, Maryland, they gave us our shots, they gave us clothes and so forth, and then they shipped us up to New York at the harbor up there, and we knew now we were heading overseas, and being we were in New York, most of us, they still had not told us anything, but we assumed, in New York, we were probably going to Europe, and We got on a ferry boat and took us out on, in fact, it was dark outside, we just went across the Bay Area there, and pretty soon I saw a huge I thought it was a building, but it was the Queen Mary, one of the largest ships in World War II, which was a British sea liner to haul dignitaries and everywhere across wherever. And it was built to hold about 2,500, but it had been reconverted for troops. So we were 15,000 guys, including there was 500 Red Cross and nurses on board with us. And so from 2,500, and we were now 15,000 aboard there, and it made two trips a month. So basically the Queen Mary itself took 30,000 GIs across every month. And there was a sister ship also, the Elizabeth, which did almost the same thing. And it made across in 6 days for us. Most of the convoys of ships that many of our people went over on took up to 14 days. So we were from New York, when I saluted the Statue of Liberty and said goodbye, in 2 weeks, I was on the very front lines right on the border of Belgium and Germany with an M1 in my hand and ready to fight in 14 days. So I, in a hurry, I became a fighting guy in the 90th Division. Didn't even know there was a division called the 90th. Didn't even know there was something called the Third Army. And I heard the name General Patton. And now we're in a bunker on 2 weeks from New York. And a guy says, "Welcome aboard. You're in Germany. You're right in the Siegfried Line. You're in E Company. You're in the 358 Regiment of the 90th Infantry Division. And you're serving under General Patton in the Third Army." I mean, a staff sergeant rattled all that stuff off to us. I hadn't even seen an officer. So, and we were up and going from that day forward till we got into Czechoslovakia in May of the next year. So, welcome aboard.
that is a fine welcome aboard, right? And so that just must have been absolutely wild. And the fact that there was, and I read that there were submarines, they had to worry about submarines when they were making that journey back and forth like that, right?
Yeah, that's true. In fact, that's why it took 6 days, because we zigzagged all the way across. We'd go 7 seconds in one direction and then make a left turn and go another 7 seconds, and then make a right turn and go another 7 seconds. And that was to outmaneuver a German U-boat that would discharge I'm having a senior moment.
Were they landmines, or they had like sea mines?
They were actually torpedoes that they would launch. And because of the 7 seconds, that was something that the British learned, that if it took a number of seconds to set the explosive on the submarine to launch the torpedo. And once it went out under that 7 seconds, we were actually going from left to right, from left to right, enough that the torpedo would come by but miss the Queen Mary. So we escaped because of some people that knew what they were doing. And I'm grateful, because it traveled all by itself. So it was nice to see a couple of our Air Force people come out when we reached Scotland and kind of, you might say, escort us back into the harbor. So we're fortunate. The Queen Mary, the Queen Elizabeth, was never sunk, basically because of the speed and the maneuverability of making this left and right turn every 7 seconds, which outmaneuvered the torpedo from the U-boat. So we were fortunate, and we made it across without any incident, really.
That is, yeah, and we're happy that you did, but that is wild. I can't imagine that as a 19-year-old kid, 20-year-old kid experiencing any of that. And so moving along, so when you get to Europe, can you kind of take the kids through that? Like, what was that like right when you step on the continent, and you guys are headed east.
Yeah, I actually entered, my first combat day was February the 8th, right on a border town. There's still activity there. They had been bombed and artillery severely in the town. It was laying in basically in ruins. But we launched our first offensive, trying the pillboxes, which were bunkers really that the Germans, that Hitler had constructed, starting in 1936, and now we're in 1944 and 1945, and for 400 miles along the border, he made these bunkers and then tank traps made out of cement that stood up about 3.5 feet, so to speak, which you could not maneuver through only by on foot. But our objective was to clean these bunkers out. And the little town that we arrived in, Hobscheid, there probably wasn't more than a few hundred people. I think there was about 12 to 15 homes in this little village, a little farming town. But there were because this was in a mountainous area, there was over 100 pillboxes or bunkers. We called them pillboxes, but they were extra bunkers that housed their troops and had access to machine gun and to cannon fire and so forth. So when you start cleaning out just one segment like we did for over 100 bunkers, it takes a while to clear them out. And we lost people doing it. But I think the casualties was heavy on the other side because we were giving them everything we could give them in firepower and so forth. And we had some great artillery people behind us, the 90th Division and supporting units. We had armored tanks from several different units that we followed us all the way across Germany and pushing them a day at a time, or maybe just pushing back maybe a block or two at a time. It depended on how severe they were trying to either hold up an area or something or whatever, but it was tough going. We had snow, we had rain, and it was the coldest winter in Europe in 50 years. So many of us, a lot of our casualties had frostbite and had to go back to the rear. Some of them lost their toes to frostbite. I came very close to losing mine, but it took years after the war to finally get good circulation again because it was so cold, and I just had well, not we were not accustomed to that type. And then we did, at nighttime we went to bed in the snow, just covered ourselves up with maybe one blanket or whatever. So it was just extremely cold winter, and especially from someone like me come from sunny California, you know, and get into that kind of weather, it was not easy.
And what you were describing is, and historically they refer to it as the Siegfried Line, that you were involved in, the Siegfried Line?
Yes, yeah. Once we broke through there, and was able to get our tanks and armor through, most of them had to go through the streets or roads because, like I said, the Siegfried Line was covered with tank traps, which were offset probably maybe as deep as, or I should say as wide as maybe 20 feet, 25 feet of all these cement abutments sticking up. And only could you go through with a tank on a road or a street or something that was wide enough to let a tank through. And there the Germans would hone in with artillery or mortars or whatever. So we lost a lot of good people. Our armored people were just dedicated. I can't say enough about them, and try to stay in touch with relatives of some of these tankers. We didn't do it alone. We had help, I'm grateful for people like General Patton, who knew what he was doing, knew how he had to cover us with as much protection as we could. But yet, infantry, you're on your feet. We walked many times, walked 20 miles maybe in a day, moving up to catch up where the enemy was again. I'm glad I was that young because I was so innocent. I didn't know what was happening from day to day, except that I was experiencing it 24 hours a day. And I think the cold was probably one of our worst enemies. And however, Hitler was determined that he was going to stop us, but he didn't know the American GI. He didn't know the tenacity and the leadership that we enjoyed. And he condemned his own people. Instead of praising them, he condemned them, you know. So fortunate for us, we overcame. And I believe the good Lord was with us, giving knowledge to some of our leadership, and we were able to make maneuvers that they could not contain.
And you had mentioned about General Patton, and not many of you know this, but my son is named after General Patton. He's the greatest American general of all time. And so he helped liberate a lot of countries. I know we have friends all over in Europe over there. He helped give freedom and democracy to other countries around the world through his sacrifices. So we thank him for all of his endeavors. And so there was an incident that I read about where you were bogged down in a pillbox and you were the lone survivor. What was it? It was almost 2 weeks, 10 days that you guys were fighting.
I'm sorry, Ralph. I really didn't get
where you were in a pillbox with other soldiers and you were the lone survivor.
Oh, that happened 2 weeks after I entered combat. I had two fellows with me, two GIs. one was from California and one was from the East Coast. And I didn't know them until we were riding in a truck going up to the front lines before I even knew we were going to be in the 90th Infantry. But the three of us we pulled into this little town called Hobscheid. And the driver says, "You three guys get off right here. See that church over there? You go sit in that church and some guy will come and get you." Boy, no, that was a lot of information. "You three guys get off of this truck, go sit in that church, and somebody will come and get you." But fortunately, when it got dark, a fellow from E Company, from the squad I was later to be introduced in, came up in the dark and met the guy that was taking us out into a pasture. And we were told not to say one word. And so we walked there, and one of these fellows, Irving Wigton, he wore what we call today Coke bottle glasses. He couldn't see, and he hollered. He started out of the church, and he said, "Schmidt, I can't see." I said, "Just hang on to my belt." So I literally pulled him along, or he hung on to my belt till we got into the bunker there and found out he had, you know, like I said, I don't know why they put him in the infantry because of his eyesight. He had no big Coke bottle glasses and couldn't see very good. But when we got right up to the up on this 10th day of combat, we were met by my sergeant and a fellow that was carrying the walkie-talkie radio. And I had become kind of a friend of this guy that carried the walkie-talkie radio. He had a very Eastern accent, and I loved him, and I just couldn't. He and I just tuned in, and the sergeant came up and said, "I'm going to send Marcus back to the rear for a while and get a little R&R relaxation." And he says that he wants you to carry the radio. He thinks you can carry this radio, but you carry it and you stay right with me. Wherever I go, you follow me because I may need that radio. So that pulled me away from Robert Roper and Irving Wigton, two of my buddies. They start digging in together on the side of this hill. And the sergeant said, "Follow me." And there was one lone foxhole that the Germans had probably built just maybe the day before. And it was pretty well protected. And they had put limbs and dirt and all kinds of stuff on top to make a roof. And so he said, crawl in here with me. And we had just barely crawled in, and the Germans let loose two artillery pieces. And they had what they called a timed arm. They timed the projectile to what we called a tree burst. They were timed to explode maybe 15 to 20 feet above you and explode, and just the shell would come into maybe hundreds of hot metal pieces, shards. And one shell came and just exploded above where Wigton and Roper were. Roper never knew what hit him. This is sad stuff to talk about, but Roper never knew what hit him. And Wigton, I heard him yell for a medic, and he dropped. And then a machine gunner just about 30 feet away, he got hit at the same time, and it killed him. And his helper was wounded severely. A medic brought him into the foxhole where my sergeant and I were. And he asked me, he said, please help me get this man sedated and let's help him get his wounds bandaged up and so he can be evacuated back to the rear. And he was severely wounded, had a large wound in his thigh, and we had to use a bayonet and cut off part of his uniform for we could put a bandage on him. And then I looked down by his foot, and I said, hey, medic, look here. I said, his heel of his foot is gone, bleeding like everything. The boot was gone. There, half of his boot was just blown away and bleeding. So we had to bandage up and do a kind of a makeshift on a heel that he didn't have anymore. When we actually stopped the bleeding and got him sedated so we could actually work with him. And then we evacuated him. That was my very first experience out of a bunker and seeing one of our own guys really, really cut up pretty bad. And I don't know the outcome, but I got word at 50, 60 years later, I found who he was through various people of our organization. I found out who he was able to contact a family and, find out who the man, find out what even his name and so forth. So I felt maybe I had a little point, a little part in helping one of our own guys survive and live through it and stop the bleeding and get him evacuated. But that was a terrible day. That it just didn't go good. And that happened daily to all kinds of our people. But that was my real first experience, and it was tough. I was barely 19 years old and very sheltered in my growing up years, and to see stuff like this and to see the pain and the suffering, it was tough. But we survived. We had good leadership and we survived.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And you say you played a little part, you played a major part, and I'm glad that you were able to connect with that gentleman's family. And so going chronologically, you go from there and you guys crossed a number of rivers and then into the city of Mainz. And is that how we pronounce it?
The city of Mainz?
Mainz. My apologies. Mainz. Yeah. Can you take us there when you guys are entering Flossenbürg, entering Mainz?
Yeah. Patton ordered the 90th Division to be the first division to reach the Rhine in that particular area. However, it had already been reached kind of accidentally up north of us with, I think, the 9th Infantry Division and an armored unit way up. They had they had able to get across a real stable bridge, they thought, but it collapsed the next day by German people who did help demolish it. But we were sent up to Mainz, one of the largest cities on the Rhine River, and very well defended. So that was another rough day. We were pinned down by an enemy we couldn't even see or know where he was. but we were pinned down in an orchard just on the outside of the city of Mainz, which was a large city at that time. Population, I think, at that time was around 300,000, which was a lot of people back there in the 40s. But we inched our way along in there, and the bullets were whizzing down over our heads, probably just a couple of inches. But we were laying in an apple orchard that had furrows plowed in it to irrigate, that run the water through there. And we crawled into that furrow and inched our way along. I drug my M1. In fact, I filled my M1 with sand, dragging it through there, which was a no-no in training. But the first time I pulled the trigger, it cleaned that sand right out of the barrel and kept on going. But I have to give our Air Force some real credit. One of our guys carrying one of those walkie-talkie radios actually radioed the Air Force for some help. And almost within, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes, four P-47 fighter planes. Each one of those has 8 50 caliber machine guns, 4 in each wing. And 4 of those, one right behind the other, came with it such close to us that we... I say I could almost see the rivets on the airplane and almost see the pilot in the seat there. And they just came on treetop level and made several passes. Now, 4 times 8 is 32. That was 32 50 caliber machine guns coming down at our enemy. And they really, really did their job. We were able to, after they left, who they didn't kill or injure, or the rest of them were scared spitless. I mean, they were wanting to get out of there. So we entered some houses, and we found a few of them in there. A couple of them went out one of the houses below us, and I turned to my buddy who had a BAR in his hand, and I said, "Hey, Mac," I said, "they're coming up to get us. They just come out of that house." Well, he came right to the window and leaned that BAR down there and brrr, brrr. He looked at me and grinned. He said, "Hey, Smitty, they ain't coming up." You know, so things like that happened. And within an hour, three of us GIs, we went into the houses there. Three of us captured over 50, I think it was 52 or 54 German soldiers. I had 18 come out of a basement. They could have killed me, but they were so scared. Those P-47s had really took the fighting spirit out of them. They come out of that basement and handed me their rifle. They could have killed me, but they handed me their rifle. I pulled the firing device out of it, threw it over the fence so it could not be used. And I had a stack of 18 German weapons laying there by me. And we marched these guys, took these guys, 18 guys out on the street, and here, my other two buddies, between us, we had 54 prisoners. And we asked them to get out their handkerchiefs, their white handkerchiefs, and put on a stick, and we marched them out toward the rear and turned them over we turned them over to the authorities who knew how to get rid of them. But that was that was the city of Mainz. And we did suffer casualties. And the next day we walked about 30 miles down to a couple little cities where our engineers had put up a bridge to handle armor and infantry. And we walked across, got about halfway across, and one lone German fighter plane came down, tried to strafe us. But he didn't know that on both sides of the Rhine River, we had half-tracks vehicles. Each one had a 50 caliber machine gun in the back. Instead of one barrel, there were 4 barrels all connected. So every half-track had 4 50 caliber machine guns. All the 4 were all in sync with one another. And this poor old guy, he come down to strafe us. And I mean, he didn't get all the way down. All of a sudden, whoosh, I saw big black smoke and then red flame, and down he went. And that happened all day and all night. They were trying to knock that bridge out because they knew if that bridge was intact, they could get troops across. But we, it was kind of exciting to watch the action from, now we're on the ground and we're knocking these airplanes down one by one. It was kind of exciting, although those poor guys, I'm sure most of them were killed, but that was the city of Mainz and the crossing there. And from there on, boy, it was, now we're headed toward the east, toward Czechoslovakia. But that was another monumental thing that we did there in the city of Mainz. I've been back there several times since. It's a beautiful city. But it was pretty much in rubble when we left it. So, but I'll never forget. Those are kind of stories that stick with you, and you just don't forget the action that took place there.
I bet. And from Mainz, correct me if I'm wrong, but from Mainz, you guys made your way through to Flossenbürg?
No, we crossed the Rhine on March the 24th. We didn't get into Czechoslovakia till almost the last week in April. Flossenbürg was on the 23rd, which is Flossenbürg was about a month away from Mainz. Between that time, we turned instead of directly east, we turned northeast and went up toward Berlin, and that's where we made another historical discovery and a historical World War II story, where we came up to the Merkers salt mines. This is where salt was mined from 50 years prior to us coming there. So there was cavernous underground, hundreds of factories. The Merkers, Hitler had used the Merkers salt mine to hide, you might say, looting things that the Germans took a lot of, like, Rembrandt paintings and so forth from various sculptures from all over the world that had assembled in Europe. They took those and hid them down in there, along with their money. They had American greenbacks stacked in there. They had all kinds of money. There was millions and millions and millions of dollars of gold, of bullions. I've seen them. Looked like a loaf of bread, solid gold. And today there's a Jeep down in there, and there's a GI's a mannequin, and he has one of these big gold bullions in his hand, and he's handing it to another GI. And these were all 90th Division guys. This one mine, and I've been bound back there twice, been down in there. One of them is 1,500 feet below the surface. So, that was a real undertaking. And when we struck this mine and found the money, even Patton was there. So many generals came. I had a picture of them with those guys going down on. There was an elevator that they made and that the Germans used, huge elevator, and they're going down. And Patton was with them there, and they were making, it made history, it made noise all over the world about finding all this gold. So there again was a plan that Hitler planned to use after he had conquered the whole nation over there and a worldwide deal, and he was going to set up a new country, so to speak. But we intercepted that, and then from that was up north toward Berlin, but still probably about 100 miles something about 100 miles yet south of Berlin. Then we turned right south and east and headed for the border of Czechoslovakia. And we reached the border early April, but our orders were to go straight south, stay along the border. And we were mopping up Germans like you wouldn't believe. We made one penetration. In fact, Eisenhower had asked Patton to make an entrance into Czechoslovakia to see just what we were facing, because we were pushing the Germans, the Russians were pushing them from the north, and we were pushing them from the west, and now pushing them all right toward Czechoslovakia. And so Eisenhower told Patton to cut a hole in there and check out, see what type of resistance might still be there. And so we were the first division to cut Germany in half. And then we went on south about 50 miles, I guess, and then where we found Flossenbürg. And we had no knowledge except the day before. And this is where today, man, we got more information on the wrist of our hand than we had in our whole organization. We just knew the day before that there was a concentration camp, and we could probably expect maybe several thousand people there. Actually, there was 30,000 people that had already been evacuated out of Flossenbürg. Anybody that could walk was forced out of there with guards and weapons and dogs out of there on a death march toward Dachau, the next concentration camp south of us, about 150 miles. So when we got there, and I was with E Company, so my unit was on the outside, kind of a guard to guard and make sure everybody was safe around us there. And actually C Company of my battalion actually went in there, and they could not believe what they were seeing. They found a total of less than 1,500 people in there, mostly Jews, and most of them were closer to death than life. So many of them were just walking skeletons, 50 pounds maybe. Anyway, these people were emaciated. They had typhus. They had diseases. The 1,500 were people that could not get out of bed and walk. I was with the squad that went down along the border there. It was a death march out of there that originally, like I said, was close to 20,000 on various death marches. The one we were on had 11,000 on the death march, and in 10 days, half of them were dead, either from starvation or if they fell and were, you know, could not stand up. A guard would come by and just pull out his rifle and blow the guy away, walk to the edge of the path there and dig a little trench and just roll him in there. On our 10 days, as we were going south toward Austria, you know, we would see a leg sticking out of the ground or an arm sticking out of the ground. They just hastily buried him. And like I said just a minute ago, out of 11,000 on the march we were encountered, there was a half of them had died within 10 days. It was a pitiful thing. The 90th set up a field hospital out there to help, and then several divisions. General Patton moved a bunch of help in there to medical people to help these people as much as he could. And many of them were just young people. They were the ones they were the only ones that could survive. And I have been privileged to meet them. I had one call me from New York that was on that death march, call me and wish me a happy birthday the other day. And I had one several years ago, came and knocked on my door. And he said, "Are you Vern Schmidt?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "My name's Lou Coverdun. I was on that death march that you talked about and showed in the newspaper the other day." He said, "I want you to know I was on that death march, and I want you to know that you're my liberator." I said, "Well, I don't even know you." He said, "I know that." But he said, "I know who you are. You helped liberate me. I was 21 years old and weighed 62 pounds. Now, folks, that's next to being closer to death than you are to life. But there's a man again. He thanked me profusely for saving his life. I never knew him, but he knew who those GIs from the 90th Division were. So those have been, and I've had story after story of meeting. I've met probably six or eight that were on this death march that knew exactly where we were and the day where we were, and have said, "You are my liberator." So these are, you know, there again, I was just one of many, but we've been singled out over the years, and it's been a thrill to know that one guy out of, actually, in the height of war over there, there was over 6 million American GIs and women women in the service during that time, so over 6 million. And now I'm 97, one of those 6 million. So, but I just had a small part. But I looked back and I said, you know, I think Eisenhower and people like him and Patton, real generals who knew what it was to fight, and they just became, I mean, they made it happen, and they softened it up and made it happen faster than probably the Germans even realized. But so once we entered, I say Flossenbürg, I will never forget, and never forget the people that I have been privileged to meet. I've been able to go back when they actually have an event where Jewish people from all over the world come there on April 23rd and have a 2 to 3 day, you might call it a reunion, but they come there to look at each other and thank each other. And in 2015, I was part of their program. I knew the director. In fact, I invited him in 2009 when I first met him to come to America and come to one of our 90 division reunions. And we also, at that reunion, we had about three survivors from the Holocaust who lived in America now came and joined us. And there was a lot of tears shed, but a lot of rejoicing. And when I was there in 2015, they singled me out and we were able to share some things. And lady came over to where I was sitting. She said, "Mr. Schmidt, my father's sitting over there in a wheelchair. He was on that death march. He knows who you are. Would you come over there? He wants to meet you." So I walked over there and sat down with him and began. He could not speak a word of English. He was from Belgium. Couldn't speak a word of English, but his daughter spoke fluent English. So she interpreted as he shared his thanks to me. And the tears just rolled down his cheeks. He said, "You are my liberator. You saved me." I said, "You know, Mr. Durness, I don't know you." He said, "I know that." But he said, through his daughter, he said, "I know who you are." And they're so grateful. He just passed away 2 years ago, and now up in Belgium. But grateful people. I get emotional when I think about what those people's suffered from some of them 6-8 years in concentration camps. It's a miracle that they're even alive. But there again, like I said a minute ago, I had this one guy even came to my door here in Fresno and wanted to thank me. So I was just one of many that helped bring this thing to a close and make us one victorious nation. From the military, then we came with help afterwards to help rebuild the Marshall Plan, help rebuild the country. They love us today. We're probably their best ally, the German people today, and Austria. So we've been blessed to help these individuals. And there again, I was just one of many. So, but I'm grateful that I've been back 8 times. Taking my family every time back with me. In fact, we were scheduled to go this coming year, but my military division unit is holding a reunion in on the East Coast on the very same week. So my family has kind of said, "Vern or Dad, I think we better go to the East Coast for a reunion there and maybe omit going over to Flossenbürg." But I would love to go over there again. And if I'm able to, I may go next year. These people love us and they're forever grateful for the American. And, you know, we were called the ugly American. I can't believe that kind of trash. I don't think we were the ugly American. Maybe 2 or 3 got out of line. Maybe 200 or 300 got out of line. I don't know. But we came over there with a mission. And we accomplished that mission. I believe to this day, the German people are one of our greatest allies for what we did for them.
Absolutely. And just to give you guys, the students, an idea, again, this is from Tony Fosco at the Arizona Jewish Historical Society, who provided this. This is all of the concentration camps. There's even more than this from what I've found out from some survivors, that there were mini camps, smaller camps outside of these major camps. And Flossenbürg, just to give you an idea, is right here. I know some of you are in these areas of Spain, Italy, France, and even Germany. So definitely, Vernon, we can't thank you enough. And you are, I know you don't think it, you are, but you are a hero, a modern day, just modern day superhero. And you truly are just, we can't wait to celebrate you for generations and years to come. Moving your story along. So, you guys obviously investigated the stuff that went on in the camps, the United States Army did, and helped with the Nuremberg trials and helped for the prosecution of the war crimes by the Germans. And here's a photo of Vern. This is this is in 1946 in Germany, is it? Right here, Vern?
Well, there are several pictures there of the concentration camp. The one in the middle with me, this is in 1946. You can see we actually got to put on our first and look the best wherever we went. This was just outside of Nuremberg, that picture. The others are, I see several of them, Flossenbürg, and one looks like it could be over there in Dachau. And there's another one there of Flossenbürg on the left-hand side. There's one of the furnaces where they cremated. And on the upper right, there's a black spot up there. Those are bodies. I shouldn't say bodies. Those were bodies maybe 2 or 3 hours prior. Those are ashes that are people out of Flossenbürg, that to get rid of them, because they couldn't feed them, they didn't have enough food. They would put them in over here to the left, the center picture. That's one of the incinerators where they rolled a body in there. And over up the top right up there is the ashes on the ground out there that we saw when we came in there. Again, I was 19 years old. In fact, I was still 19 when we were there. It really works on you. You know, it's hard to believe that you and I would do something like that. But Hitler was a crazy man. I feel he was interjected with devilish thoughts, but he thought he was the king of the world. But and then he committed suicide before the war was even over. But yeah, that's I'm just thankful. I every day I can hardly sometimes. How come Roper and Wigton and Estep all were blown away and never got the chance like I did to come home and be, I've been called a hero. I wasn't a hero. I was just one of the guys that helped make it end. But I've been blessed. I had such a, my daughter and I had such a wonderful time with Tony Fusco back there in Phoenix last year. We just had a great time with those people. Gracious, those survivors we met were just, I said, maybe we had a part in these people's lives today. So it just makes you feel, if there's young people watching today, be grateful that you live in America or you live in a land that's free, that people love life and love one another and enjoy to the fullest the freedom that you enjoy because of, from our country, 400,000 never came home. So they made an ultimate sacrifice for some of you, even watching today. Maybe your mom, maybe your dad, maybe your grandpa, maybe your great grandpa was involved. They also had a part in it. So I'm just grateful, and to have friends and maybe to share a little bit today. Maybe someone might pick up something that I said. I hope you makes you feel proud that you live in the country. And and there's my good friend Jack Terry, who was on our last Zoom program. Tony, you remember him too. But now he laid down his life just a little over about six about 6 weeks ago, I guess. Maybe not even that long, but a grateful guy, a survivor, little 14-year-old boy standing at the gate welcoming the 90th Division. He said, I have no reason to live. My whole family, everybody's been murdered or died or killed. I'm the sole survivor. I have nothing to go home. I don't even have a country. But one of our GIs took a uniform and cut it down, had a seamstress cut it down to fit him. He became a little mascot for us and dressed like a regular GI. And as we moved on, they made sure that he wound up with other people of our caliber. And they eventually got him back to New York with some of his Jewish they probably became friends, but that was his passport to America, was through a Jewish person. And he joined the military and fought as an officer in the United States Army Korean War, I guess it was. Yeah. So no, it was in the Vietnam War. I'm sorry. But what a neat guy. I met him so many times at Flossenbürg and then came to our reunions and just loved America. He says, you saved me or I wouldn't even be here today had it not been for the 90th Infantry Division that liberated me. So there again, as you see, the background is one of our 90th Division called a sniper. It's one of our newsletters that came out. And I've just been privileged to know people like Jack Terry and people who have done so much, though he thought he was better off dead because he knew nobody. But somebody planted a little seed of friendliness and put a little uniform on him and made him feel important. And he is important. He was important. We're all important. And we should be grateful for the freedom that we enjoy from one day to the next. So anyway,
amen.
I love that man.
Amen. And here are some more clips from throughout. I mean, you did something when you were in your teen years and your 20 and you were in your 20s, and it echoed for the rest of your life. I mean, it's unimaginable. Like you pretty much lived a movie when you were a kid. Like all these unimaginable situations that would make a lot of people scared, you went through it and you rose above that perseverance. Can you tell us, take us through some of these photos?
Yeah, the top two are taken right here back a few months ago when the Czech Republic brought two gentlemen, this one up here on the upper left hand, he was a colonel in the Czech Republic Army. He flew out here and brought another fellow with him and their wives. And they presented me with an honorary 75th year commemoration of the Czech Republic's becoming now a free nation because of the United States, our armed forces coming into their country. And actually, they were fearful. In fact, they were under Russian domain for almost 50 years till we took care of that. Also, the lower picture on the left is I'm riding in an American restored World War II vehicle in the parade in Pilsen, Czechoslovakia, one of the biggest cities in the Republic. Coming down, there was thousands and thousands and thousands of people on both sides of the street. And then we wound up in a city square, and they honored us again. And there's where I met Helen Patton for one of the second or third times, that's the granddaughter of General Patton. And we have become great friends. Upper right is in the parade there in Pilsen in 2015. In fact, all of those are from the parade other than the colonel from the Czech Republic pinning on the 75th year of the Czech's freedom because of the American GI. And they singled me out, I guess because there are not too many of us alive anymore, but they came and we had a great reception. These people are so grateful, and we kind of made the headlines for a day or so while they were out here. And I can never you just, if you go to Czechoslovakia and you tell them you're an American, you're going to be honored. They love us for what we did. They suffered after we liberated them. They suffered when occupation took over. Czech Republic became mostly occupied by the Russians, and they did not treat these people like we did. So when President Reagan took over, went over there and he said, Gorbachev, tear down that wall, that's when these Russians were ushered back into where they belong, and we came back in again. And so we actually, they claim we liberated them twice. And this is one of their colonels who just, he said, we can't say enough good about you Americans. And they singled me out because somebody said, there's an old guy up here near Fresno. He was there. So they found me and flew out here, they and their wives. We just had a great time. And I got a wonderful reception from our local veteran groups over in Clovis. The people just loved them, but you wouldn't believe them. I was supposed to be the main guy there, but no, these people came to thank us for what we did. It was a great time. I've been so privileged to be involved in something like this. And that parade there, it went back, that was in 2015. That's 8 years ago. And they treated us like royalty. And I'm just representing the United States of America, not Vern Schmidt, but I'm representing the people who set them free, the United States of America military. So anyway, we upper right picture is also there. my name on the bumper, so everybody could see who I was. They didn't leave out anything. They people, and you can see the vehicle I'm riding in, and the lower left bumper is the word 90th. That was a redone for the parade, 90th Infantry Division, one of their liberators. They never will forget. And there was over 300 World War II vehicles in that parade. Can you imagine? From all over Europe, people came to that celebration, freedom celebration, from all over. 300 World War II vehicles of every kind, tanks, armored cars, wreckers, everything you could think of, jeeps, trucks, ambulances, and everyone thanking the Americans for what they did.
That is absolutely, that must have been wild. That must have been absolutely wonderful. And of course, this is Laura Bailey, who her, along with Tony Fusco, today's event would not be possible without them. So we can't thank Laura and Tony enough. But if you want to tell us a little bit about this, was this taken at the World War II Museum?
Yes, this is in Fort Benning, Georgia, where we were 2 years ago. And that's one of the times where I met Laura, and she said, we're going to go. And so you can see, we found the 90th Division patch. We're both pointing to it right there. And she said, that's where you all, where it all started. So yeah, it was great. And we were privileged there to dedicate some more memorials in the woods alongside of World War II tanks out there at Fort Benning, Georgia. What an honor again to be part of this. I knew nothing about it. We just showed up and they put something wonderful together. And Laura and her husband have been so good to us. And she has been a researcher. She's an author. She's a dedicated military background. She wants to know everything that happened. And she has. She has given so much to so many people already of her background, which is strictly all military. And aside from her being a part of a huge organization that builds things today for us, she's, you'd think she's fixated 24 hours a day on American history, especially from World War II.
Well, we can't thank Laura and we can't thank Tony enough and we can't thank you enough. Do you mind if we jump into some student questions for you?
Go ahead. Go ahead. I'm, I, I wish I would have taken a little time and kind of cleaned up a little bit. I'd look like an old, old guy, but I can put
makeup
on my face and I look about 10, 15 years younger, but you caught me unaware this morning.
You look A-OK. You look A-OK. So we have a question from one of our friends in Italy. This is Mev. Mev, you should be able to unmute. You had a very good question for our friend Vern.
Hello, sir. Nice to meet you. I'm 18, like the age you were when you went to war, and it makes me think a lot. Can you tell us about the war episode that most impressed you as an 18-year-old boy? Thank you.
So I'll help you out a little bit, Vernon. So she wants to know what had the biggest impression on you as a teenager in war?
Well, as I alluded to earlier, we were really raised in a sheltered environment. We were in an agricultural area where people worked for a living and loved each other. The little town of Ridley, I think 12 churches. So, you know, we were people who loved to worship and loved one another and were happy. And of course, many of us who left there were just kids. In our little church alone, there was close to 45 of us left our little church in Ridley, just a small church of about close to 250 people. And about 40 of us went off to war. And it went everywhere, went in the Army, went Navy, Air Force, Marines. We served in everywhere we could. But we had a big marquee up on the front by the where the pastor spoke, and had all of our names there with a little star in front of us. And someone 24 hours a day, someone out of that congregation, either in the church or at home or on their knees, asking God's presence and God's direction and God's protection on us who had gone off to answer the call. I'd like to just say, every single one returned. My brother was probably the most severe wounded one. He was with the 42nd Rainbow Division over there and was attacked by Hitler's crack SS division that came out of Sweden up there in the north and came there and tried to annihilate them. My brother was wounded both in the back and in his, he had a graze right across the chin here where a bullet just grazed him, and his back was full of small shrapnel. And he was captured at the very same time, never got one bit of medication all his time, other than perhaps an aspirin in the concentration camp there. And, you know, but every single one came home. So we are grateful people. That helps us today yet, because we know we were survivors because somebody was on their knees asking God's protection on us. And so, you know, maybe that's why this old 97-year-old guy is still around. But I'm grateful. I have some wonderful friends. I have wonderful family. And I just got added bigger now with the Laura Bailey family and some of her good close friends. So we have been blessed. I don't know if I answered your question or not.
No, you did. You did. And it sounds like, you know, you have a serving, God-fearing attitude. And it sounds like that played quite a big part in your survival through such unimaginable adversity at such a young age. We have a question from Gabriel, go ahead and unmute to ask. You had a really good question, friend.
Hi, nice to meet you. Hi, my question is, have you had some fears during your journey in Europe? And if yes, how did you deal with them?
How did you deal with the fears of when you were in war? How did you deal with that? Because that had to be very scary, is what he was asking.
Like I just talked about my little church, I stood on that ground daily. I said, you know, somebody is interceding for my behalf. And I was, again, I was one of millions over there, you know. So somebody, our nation rallied in World War II, something that we don't see. I'm sorry we don't see it like that today, but our country rallied. I mean, everybody locked arms and said, we're a part of it too. And the people that stayed home and Rosie the Riveter and the people who worked in the factories and the people who helped build our equipment that we used, they didn't make any, General Motors, a great big organization, didn't make one piece of civilian equipment from 42 to 46. They built tanks, they built Jeeps, they built trucks, they built all kinds of military stuff. And that's getting together, you know, when you just can't knock that. You got to thank how we locked arms, whether we were civilians or whether we were in the service. We were one big family trying to make things come to an end and take care of that guy called Hitler, who he and Tojo over there in Japan, you know, we just had to knock the socks off of those guys and put them away. And we did. Not I, but everybody in America who was building equipment for us, our medical people who were sending medical supplies for us, the ships that took the people over there, that took supplies over there. We were locked arms in making this thing happen. So, you know, I appreciate being able to share a little bit, but I'm just one of, like I said, there was 6 million of us wound up over in Europe alone. So I had a little part, and I'm thankful for it. I'm grateful that I'm alive and be able to share my gratefulness that's still being alive today. And my family is with me. Part of my family went with me every trip I took back over there over the last years. Like I said, I made 8 trips back, and I've tried to go to Flossenburg, tried to go to Normandy. My unit landed at Normandy. I did not. I was still in the States training, but my unit landed at Normandy and suffered casualties. I knew personally 2 guys. I met them here in California who walked ashore there on D-Day, June 6th, 1944. And there's people today that said the 90th did not land there. They came later. Well, that's true. One ship, a British ship, sunk out there, struck a German landmine, and everybody went down with the ship, but everybody came back up as the ships came, and not one soul on that ship was lost. All American GIs ready to land at Normandy. The ship went down, the guys rallied, and various ships come right up to the sinking ship, rescued every single person off that ship, went back to England to get resurfaced and get resupplied and so forth. And they landed on D+2 at Omaha Beach. So the 2 beaches, Utah Beach and Omaha Beach, two companies of the 90th landed on D-Day, embedded in with the 4th Infantry Division, because they had made mock landings already and knew what it was to jump off of a boat and walk ashore. So they embedded in with the 4th Infantry. And I've been there where they walked ashore. I walked on the very same sand where these guys walked ashore. And there again, we're happy that we had a little part in liberating the countries of Europe that were so depressed and under Hitler's arms at that time. Well, we just showed up and we did our job.
Yeah, and we have a lot of Italians on here. So there's Mussolini, that there was the liberation from him as well. So, and you guys will learn about that. Hopefully, if you already haven't, we'll have a guest who has played a part in that in the next couple of weeks. So we have a couple more student questions. This one I'll read to you because the student has a microphone that's not working. She wanted to know, could you describe to us the feeling that you and your fellow soldiers had when you knew the war was coming to an end?
Well, sometime today we say you can smell it coming. As we entered Czechoslovakia on the first day of May, again, communications, we only knew what 12 guys were doing side by side. The rest of us, we were spread out all over the country of Czechoslovakia. We knew things were coming to an end because the Germans, they're humans just like us. They didn't want to be killed on the very last few weeks of the war or whatever. So they survived by the thousands all along there. And because they had families, they had, you know, they valued life just like we did, but they were being, we were forcing them into a smaller area. And of course they wanted to survive. So many of them by the thousands gave up. And yet we had guys killed as late from my unit on May the 5th, a bunch of German Hitler Youth kids had taken over an American armored car, mounted up on it, and came down the road where one of our companies or squad leaders or guy squad was coming up. And one of the guys in this American said, "Hey, look at there. I thought we were going to take this down. Here comes an American armored car our way already." And when they got close enough, the kids in that, they were Hitler Youth kids, grabbed the 50 caliber. They sprayed back and forth and back and forth, killed close to one says around seven, but actually I think there was close to about over a dozen of them killed, and about 20 of our guys wounded. But one of our guys grabbed their rifles and they, I think, killed every single one in that armored car. It was just Hitler kids, youth kids, 13, 14, 15 years old, mesmerized by old Hitler himself. So, but that happened on the very, almost the very last day. On the 7th day of May, General Dönitz, who had taken over from Hitler, said, "It's time to surrender." And he officially surrendered to the Americans and the British. And I think it took the next day before the Russians actually were involved as well. And by that time, we had Russians. We had already on the either the 7th or 8th day, I forget, probably the 7th, I met a German pilot. He landed his airplane right out in the meadow where we were. He had another guy in the back of the airplane with a big megaphone and was trying to round up Germans that were still hiding in the woods in there. Europe is a very wooded or place, so there are lots of forests and lots of trees, and not a good place to hide. You can't find you in those trees. But this guy was in riding in the back seat of this open cockpit airplane. And he was holding the megaphone and calling for surrender. He landed there, a Russian pilot. So I met this guy. I walked out there, and he couldn't talk English, and I couldn't talk Russian. But I had a German 38 caliber pistol on my, I took it out of the holster and handed it to him and let him look at it and so forth. And I noticed he had one on his hip. I reached out to get a chance to hold his weapon, and he slapped my arm away. And I thought, you know, my first impression of those Russians was not good. And it continued that. I'm sorry to say, some of it still holds in my heart right now today. But anyway, that's toward the end of the war. We were grateful when we heard that the Germans had initiated the surrender. And the first night to actually sleep in a house, and some Czech lady make you a sandwich with full of beautiful homemade jelly on top. Man, that tasted good. And to be able to actually sleep inside of a house, whether it be on a floor or on a mattress or whatever. And we found those people so wonderful. So, you know, it's for me, it started hard and rough and cold, and it ended with such friendship and warmth, and you just felt like a hero, you know? So that's how it ended for us on the 7th day, but it was declared officially, I think, before all the newscasters and everything got settled down, to be on May 8th, 1945. I'm sorry, 1946.
That's absolutely wonderful. And we can't thank you enough. We can't thank you enough for spending time with us today and keeping this history alive for this next generation of students all over the world. And before we let you go, we have one final question. And we just wanted to know, what kind of advice would you have for these kids having lived, you know, you're still living your life, but you lived a very full life so far at 97. What kind of advice do you have for these kids as they go out into the world and figure out what they would like to do with their lives?
Well, for these young people who are probably still, many of them under 20 years old, I would say, you know, be very careful in choosing your friends. Select someone that is trying to live a good, wholesome life. People that eat and sleep decently and don't carouse around. Also, don't go to sleep at night without thanking someone or this nation for that United States flag up there, which is a symbol of our freedom. Now, just be grateful that you're an American, you were born here. You could write a book about called Born Free, because if in your age now, I'm probably great-grandfather to some of you, maybe even older than that, but be grateful that you live in a country where you can get up in the morning and nobody is at your neck trying to take you away. But choose your friends, find a good worship center that you can be grateful for and join and be part of an organization that loves this nation and shares that love with others. It takes less calories, whatever up here, less to be a good, healthy, happy citizen than be one that crabs, complains, and just to be a positive is a health issue. To be negative is an issue of unhealthy and heading down the wrong direction. You can be illness collected there. Just be grateful that you're a red-blooded American and that somebody way up the road of health and life saved your life and helped preserve this nation and honor this nation, honor the flag and what it stands for. It's a symbol of freedom. So put your ambition, put your daily activities centered around that somebody made what you are enjoying today happen. Many countries can't say that today, but someone, some GI, helped make that happen.
Thank you so much for the kind words and the emphasis on faith, family, freedom, and good friends. And thank you all for joining us today. And Vernon, I'm going to shut this meeting down for everybody. But before I do, I want everyone to have the opportunity to say thank you to you and thank you to Laura and thank you to Tony and everyone who helped set this up. So can we all say thank you to Vernon for taking the time to speak to us today?
Thank you, Vernon.
Thank you, Vernon.
Thank you.
Bye.